once I was staying in the city of Sawati, but not at Jetavana, at another place. And Buddha called Sariputta and asked, Sariputta, do you have faith that the faculty of faith, when developed and cultivated, has the deathless as its ground, the deathless as its destination, the deathless as its final goal? And then he asked about the other faculties, also the other four faculties. So Buddha's question was, do you have faith or do you believe that these five faculties, when developed, lead to attainment of deathless or attainment of enlightenment? And the Venerable Sariputta said, Bhante, I do not go by faith in the Blessed One about this, that these five faculties, when developed, lead to the attainment of enlightenment or lead to emancipation. So what Venerable Sariputta said was, I don't have to go by faith in the Buddha to know that when these five faculties are developed, they lead to emancipation. And he said, those who have not experienced them themselves, who have not seen them themselves, might have to go by faith in others about this. But those who have known these by themselves, who have seen them, who have experienced them, they would be without perplexity or doubt about this, that the five faculties, when developed, lead to emancipation. And he continued, I am one by whom this has been known, seen, understood, realized, and contacted with wisdom. That means I have experienced these myself. So I have known them, I have seen them, I have understood them. So he said, I am without perplexity or doubt about this. So this is what the Venerable Sariputta answered. So Buddha's question was, do you believe that when these five faculties are developed, they lead to emancipation? And Venerable Sariputta said, I don't have to go by faith in you, in the Blessed One. That means I have experienced them myself, and so I have no doubt about that. Now, this is recorded in one discourse in the Sanyutta Nikaya. And when the Venerable Sariputta gave this answer, Buddha was glad. So Buddha said, good, good, Sariputta. Those by whom this has not been seen, heard, seen, understood, and so on, they would have to go by faith in other person. But those who have seen these themselves have no doubt or perplexity about these. So Buddha was glad with the answer of the Venerable Sariputta. Now this episode was put in a story form in the Dhammapada commentary. So in the Dhammapada commentary, it is said that there were 30 monks who came from the forest. They were forest-dwelling monks. So they came there, and when they were there, Buddha asked the Venerable Sariputta this question, and the Venerable Sariputta gave the answer. And when they heard the answer, they misunderstood the Venerable Sariputta. They thought that Venerable Sariputta did not have any faith or any belief in the Buddha. So they said, Venerable Sariputta is still a Mithyadeity. Because he came from a Mithyadeity family, right? So Venerable Sariputta is still a Mithyadeity. He has no faith in the Buddha yet. And they reported it to the Buddha. So the Buddha said, no. What Sariputta meant was like this. But the explanation given in the Dhammapada commentary is a little different. Their explanation is like this. Buddha said, what I meant by that question was, do you believe that without developing the five faculties, people can get enlightenment? So Venerable Sariputta said, I don't believe in it. That is the explanation given in the Dhammapada. Maybe a little off the track. What I think is, when Buddha asked and Sariputta gave the answer, Sariputta wants to emphasize that it is not to go by faith. We are not to believe just by faith in what even the Blessed One, the Buddha, taught. Since he has himself experienced this, he had no doubt about this fact that the five faculties, when developed, lead to emancipation. So Buddha explained this, and Buddha uttered a verse. So I want to give you this verse, but it may be difficult for you to appreciate the verse because you do not understand Pali. Because this verse is like a riddle. There are puns in it. So if I translate it, the puns will be gone. So we lose the beauty of the riddle of the pun when we translate into any language. So you have to hear in the original language to appreciate the pun in the verse. So the verse, so in the verse there are words, and they have two meanings each. One is apparent meaning, and the other is, let's say, hidden meaning. So what people will understand when they hear this verse for the first time is the apparent meaning. So I will give you first the apparent meaning. So Buddha said, a person who is faithless, a person who is not grateful, and a person who breaks into houses, a person who has destroyed his opportunities, and a person who eats what has been thrown away by other people, that person is the noblest of the persons. So this is a meaning that would come to anybody who read that verse first. The hidden meaning was, faithless means who doesn't have to go by faith. He has no faith in the Buddha. That means he has no does not mean that he has no devotion for the Buddha, but he doesn't have to go by faith on these matters that he had experienced or realized himself. So he can be called a faithless person in that sense. And ungrateful person. Now, you have to understand the Pali word there. The Pali word is akatanyu. So that can mean ungrateful person, and also that can mean one who knows Nibbana. So the hidden meaning is the person who knows Nibbana, who has realized Nibbana. And one who breaks into the houses. The hidden meaning is one who breaks the joint of round of rebirth. And one who has destroyed his opportunities. That means one who has destroyed the chances to be reborn. So one who is not going to be reborn, actually. And then the last word, one who eats what has been thrown away by other people. Soften the word meaning a little down. The real meaning is one who eats what has been vomited by other persons. So, but the hidden meaning is one who has vomited the taints of mental defilements. So one who has destroyed the mental defilements. And such a person is the noblest of the persons. So if you know Pali, you can appreciate this. So at the end, the 30 monks gained enlightenment, became arahants with the four analytical knowledges. So what I want to point out in this story is the Venerable Sariputta's answers. I don't have to go by faith in the Blessed One. It would be very good for us if we also can say something like this: I don't have to go by faith in this respect to anybody. And in order to be able to say that, we just need to practice. If we practice and if we see for ourselves that the five aggregates of clinging are impermanent and so on, we can also say that I don't have to go by faith. I have seen for myself that five aggregates are impermanent and so on. So when you practice Vipassana meditation, you are trying to get to such a state. Or many of you have reach some of those stages of knowledge where you have seen the mind and matter clearly, and you have seen the conditionality of mind and matter, you have seen them arising and disappearing, and you come to the understanding that they are impermanent and they are always oppressed by rising and falling, and they are insubstantial, you have no authority over them, and so on. So Buddha's teaching or Buddha's Dhamma is called Sandhitika. And Sandhitika means to be seen by oneself or can be seen by oneself. So we don't have to take by faith whatever Buddha taught. So Buddha's teaching can be and should be seen by oneself. We must make effort that so that we see it for ourselves. We see that mind and matter are impermanent. We need to see it for ourselves and not go by faith or not go by just book knowledge, not go by borrowed or second-hand knowledge. So in order to gain direct knowledge of these teachings, we should practice. So through practice, we will also be able to say, I don't have to go by faith and so on. So it is an ideal state, and this center and the teachers here are helping you to reach that stage. So there are many centers, and you can go to other centers as well. And this is one center. You can come to reach a stage where you can say, I don't have to go by faith. So if you can say that for at least some things, I think it would be very good. I don't say you should be proud of yourself. Today is the last day of our retreat. And this is a closing occasion. And I'm glad that you are able to take the retreat. And I hope you have gained something so as to be able to say, I don't have to go by faith. Every day, yogis reported to me about their experiences, and most of them are inspiring. And so I'm glad that you are able to get results from the practice. Although I always say, do not think of results, but still we think of results. Now we can. So while in the practice, it is not good to have expectations, but now you can have. And so I hope you gain moments of peacefulness, and you gain more insight into five aggregates of clinging or into mind and matter, and you are getting closer to the goal. Now, Mahasi Jara once said, suppose you have to make, say, 100,000 notes, and you will gain enlightenment. If you have 1,000 notes, that means you are closer to enlightenment by less by 1,000 notes, and so on. So I hope you are going closer and closer to your goal. And so it is important that you keep up this practice. I have talked about it many times, that this practice is not to be done once in a while. So it is a lifelong practice, and so you have to do every day. Just as you eat every day, you sleep every day, so you practice every day. And many people ask me, how to practice when they go back home or in their daily activities. Now, intense mindfulness that you practice here, it's difficult to practice when you are at home and especially in your daily activities. So I always advise people to have two levels of practice every day. So one is an intense practice as you do here, like sitting meditation. You can do it for 1 hour or half an hour, and I want you to take time and not to say, I'm too busy. I cannot find time. Because if you really want to practice, you'll find time. You can cut your time of watching television or doing some sports and so on. And so I think to get half an hour a day is not difficult. Even 1 hour a day, still not difficult. So during that time, you practice real intense mindfulness as you do here. At other times, you can practice mindfulness on a lower level. That means not going into details about the activities, but still you can be mindful of what you are doing at the present moment. So, for example, when you are driving, you can be mindful of driving and do not go into details like turning the wheel or putting the key and so on. You don't do that, you will hit other people. So, but you can be mindful of just driving, right? I'm driving like that. Suppose you are cooking. I think in this country, men also cook. So when you are cooking, you may be mindful of cooking, not going into details. Yeah? And maybe you are cleaning the house, and mindful of cleaning and so on. So if you can keep that much mindfulness, although it is not a very deep, intense mindfulness, still it is mindfulness, and it can give you many results, worldly results, in this life. You can get things done better if you are mindful with your activities. You will make fewer mistakes. Okay, I'm ashamed to say one thing now. I'm teaching mindfulness to you, and I forgot to bring some sheets with me. I'll have to go back and bring them later. So, please practice mindfulness in your daily activities also. When you practice this way, keeping it up every day, it becomes like a habit to you. And when you have a chance to take a retreat like this or a longer retreat, you go to the retreat and you can get into the practice very easily. Most yogis have to spend 2 or 3 days, the beginning days at the retreat, just to get into the practice. They are too tired or too sleepy or their mind wanders too much and so on. And so they have to struggle with it maybe 2 or 3 days. And then if it is a 1 week retreat, then the retreat is going to be over after 2 days. And so you are thinking about the end of the retreat that way. So if you keep this practice with you every day and going on every day, then you have this momentum with you. And so when you go to a place to practice meditation more seriously, you can get into it more easily. So it is good to keep mindfulness with you even when you are not practicing meditation, like sitting meditation and so on. In fact, it can do a lot of good to you. It can even save your lives. During the holiday season, There were a lot of car accidents and many people died in the accidents. Why are there so many accidents? Because the drivers are not mindful. If they are mindful, there would be very few accidents. So mechanical failure you cannot control. So if the drivers were mindful, there would be fewer accidents on the roads, and that means there would be fewer deaths. So if you are one of those persons, then you can save your lives. And you can save the lives of other people also. So mindfulness can give you a lot of results. And to practice mindfulness, you don't have to spend a penny. It is yours. It comes with you. And so you can practice it anytime. It doesn't cost anything. But don't tell me you have to pay for the retreat. This is not for the teaching and not for the practice, but the facilities you use here. So actually, you can practice mindfulness without any expenses. And it can give abundant of results. So mindfulness should be our way of life. Mindfulness should be incorporated into our daily activities. Buddha was, if I use the word smart, it may not be the praise for the Buddha, right? Mm-hmm. So Buddha was very wise to discover the value of mindfulness. Mindfulness is the property of everybody. It's so simple and so common that people don't see the value of mindfulness. But Buddha saw and discovered the value of mindfulness and give us the ways to use that mindfulness for our own benefit. It is by using mindfulness that we discover the true nature of things. We discover, let me say, secrets of mind and matter. It is using mindfulness that we build up concentration, and through concentration, we come to see the true nature of things, and we come to the realization of our goal ultimately. So mindfulness practice should be kept always. Please do not give up mindfulness. Please do not hang mindfulness at the gate when you leave. So there's a saying. With the credit card, they say, don't leave home without it. So I would like to say the same thing for mindfulness, right? don't leave home without it. So take mindfulness with you always, wherever you go or wherever you are. It can pay you rich dividends. So my advice is not to stop practicing, not to stop meditating after the retreat. Please carry on the practice and keep it always fresh, so that when an opportunity comes, you can catch that opportunity and practice in a more serious way. So the practice of mindfulness taught by the Buddha is very beneficial to all those who practice. And we are very lucky that we have the chance to understand the value of mindfulness and to practice mindfulness. If Buddha did not teach mindfulness, who would dare to teach us? we cannot find this practice of mindfulness in other teachings. It's very, very difficult to find. Nowadays, there are computers, and most religious things are on CD-ROMs. So the Bible is on CD-ROM now, and so I was curious about the word mindfulness. So I searched the word mindfulness in the Bible. I don't find it. So there is not a single instance of the word mindfulness in the entire Bible. There are the words mindful, mindful, mindful. But mindful means just the awareness or understanding, knowing or something like that. Not the mindfulness we practice. So do not think that it is easy, say, to know about mindfulness, to get chance to practice mindfulness. Only when you meet a Buddha, only when you are born, when the teachings of the Buddha are available, and only when there are teachers to teach you, you can learn about mindfulness and practice and enjoy the results. So it is a golden opportunity, a rare opportunity to be able to practice mindfulness. We may die after some years, and we do not know where we will be reborn. We may not get a chance to practice it again for many years or many lives. So this is a time to practice. Do not put it off. Or do not say that I'll practice when I'm reborn as a deva. So it is a time to do it, because we don't know where we will be after this life. So this is real. This life is real to us, and so this is a time we should be doing something for our own benefit. And when we practice for our own benefit, we are doing for benefit of others as well. We become good people, good citizens, and we don't give trouble to other people, and that is one asset. Some people say, oh, you are doing for your own benefit and you are selfish. But no. When you are a good person, you don't give trouble to another person. Huh? You do not become criminals. But if you do not practice and you fall in with bad people, you may become a criminal and maybe a burden for the society and for the government and so on. And so we are doing something for others as well when we are practicing for ourselves. We are interested in improving ourselves, that we must admit. But at the same time, we are doing some kind of favor, some kind of service to the society. So do not think about what will I be selfish if I practice for myself only and so on. Just practice. Because you have to be perfect first before you can make others perfect. You have to be a doctor first before you can treat patients. So this is the way we have things. And so when there is chance and when you have this chance, quite easily, please do not let go of this chance. Please do not miss this chance to practice meditation, especially the Vipassana meditation. So please keep it up. And with constant practice of Vipassana meditation, I wish for all of you a sooner realization of the goal, and may you all be able to attain your goal with comfort. Okay, may you all be well and happy. During my talks, I did not take any questions. That was because I did not want the yogis to be distracted and agitated while during the retreat practicing meditation. So now that retreat is over, I think I will take some questions. So if you have questions, please put it briefly and clearly. There is an offense called censuring the noble one. That means criticizing the noble persons. Noble means those who have reached enlightenment. Criticizing them or saying something bad about them. And it is important that if we have done something like that, we must ask forgiveness from that person, because it can be an obstacle to our practice. And there is a story, I've been telling this story many times, maybe at every retreat. So there were two monks, one the older and the other younger, and they both went into the village for alms. So they went for alms and they got a hot rice soup at one house. You know, monks use only bowls. So they got this hot rice soup, and the elder monk just sat on a log brought to the village for a doorpost. He sat on that log and just drank it from the bowl. So when the younger monk saw this, he criticized in his mind. He didn't say anything to that older monk, but he said, this monk cannot control his hunger. He is doing something shameful for all of us, something like that. And then they went about the village and collecting alms. And after they reached back the monastery, the older monk went to the younger monk and asked, "Friend, have you got any footing in this sasana? Have you got something to hold on to?" Something like that. Then the younger monk said, "I have reached the first stage." Then the older monk said, "Friend, do not practice anymore. You have criticized an arahant." So the younger monk bowed down and asked forgiveness. And so he was forgiven. So that story was told in our commentaries in many places. And so especially when we practice meditation, we need to do that. And If there is a person and we can go to him or to her, then we must go and ask forgiveness personally. If we cannot do that, then we can do it in the presence of a teacher, or in the presence of a Buddha statue, or even by ourselves. It is said in the books that even that dead person has died, you should go to the place of his cremation and then ask forgiveness. So the criticizing those who had good qualities, right, like noble ones, is what is important or what is damaging. And those persons will all be people of wisdom and compassion. So that is why we use that word, wisdom and compassion. So criticizing such persons is damaging to our practice, and so we try to, how to call, to clean. I use the word clean the slate. But I was told that nowadays people don't know what a slate is. So I might as well use cleaning the board. So we have to clean the board before we practice meditation, so that we can do it with clean mind or clean heart. So whether the person is of wisdom and compassion or not. Because when we say something bad about something, there is the akusa, the unwholesome mental state in our mind. And so especially that kind of unwholesome mental state can interfere with our practice. We will be remembering this many times when we practice, and so it is good to clean it before we practice. And the fact that you ask forgiveness is what counts. The other person may or may not forgive you, but that you have no control over. But you forgive, and so your heart is now pure. With that pure heart, you can practice.
Sri Kadalai, they have a question here from the yogis. They need a little more detail. I'm not sure I am able to make it precise or concise, so maybe I read it to you. Okay. Question. I have read that to become a monk, it is required that a person must have all his limbs on body part. Right.
Must what?
Yeah.
Yes. No, he must do what?
He must have all his limbs.
Okay.
Does this mean that a physically disabled person cannot ordain? Are internal organs required to be all intact as well? Am I making a reading?
I think Buddha wanted his disciples to be whole and to be good looking. Because there are many deformities mentioned in that chapter on ordination. Maybe there are more than 50 of them. So once I was reading and I was thinking, if somebody wanted to research about what deformities existed during the time of the Buddha, they should read this. So many things there mentioned. Now, it is true that Buddha said those with their hands cut, those who have no hands, or those who have no legs should not be ordained. But I think the obstacle to the real obstacle to ordination is not this, because when a person gets a higher ordination, right, we have to ask many questions, and say, are you a human being? Are you not an employee of the government? Are you free from debt, and so on? So even though they may not be able to answer yes to these questions, still monks can ordain them. Now the most important thing at the ordination is to be a human being and to be 20 years of age. So these are the important things. And then there will be a question, are you a man? So that means, are you a full man and not a hermaphrodite or not somebody without sex at all, something like that. Not that you are not a woman, because women are also admitted to the order during the time of the Buddha. So the question asks, apart from these questions, the other questions are not really damaging. So what happened is, suppose a person comes and we ordain him, although he is in the employment of the government and he is still under that service, and we ordain him. He becomes a monk, but we incur some minor offense, the offense of wrongdoing, which we can confess to each other. So there are some defects or deformities that are supposed to be not compatible with monks, and so if we can, say we have to avoid those things. It is a difficult question, because there may be somebody who wants to become a monk and he has lost his hand or something like that. I can give you later, not now.
And what is the difference between focusing one's attention on the breath at the tip of the nose versus the rise and fall of the abdomen in the form of called anapanasati? And is it a tranquility or concentration meditation technique? What makes it Vipassana meditation? I have read that achieving concentration or one form thickness of mind does not lead to wisdom or insight. But Banya cannot come without concentration. Does the Mahasiddhara method aim at developing both at the same time? By listening their attention.
Okay.
What is the difference between focusing one's attention on the breath at the tip of the nose versus the rise and fall of the abdomen?
Actually, it is the same. So, when we practice meditation, we try to get concentration. So in order to get concentration, we apply mindfulness. Mindfulness can be applied to anything, actually. But breath is always with us. And so, the breath is chosen as the object of attention. And the rising and falling of abdomen is actually the same as breathing in and out. when you breathe in and breathe out, the abdomen moves, make movements, stretching out and contracting. And so it is a manifestation of vayu dhatu or air element. So whether you keep your mind at the tip of the nose and be mindful of the breath here, or you keep the mind on the abdomen, what you are watching is the air element. That is why when you keep your mind here, we say concentrate on the nature of breath rather than the shape or form. So that means we want you to be mindful of the air element there, rather than the breath as a something that has a shape or form. So long as you are seeing the shape or form, you are taking panyati, the concept, as object. And in vipassana, you do not take panyati as object. You take what is called the ultimate reality as object. So actually, these two are the same. But if you want to go into intricacies of the practice, then here is the abdomen, and the abdomen is rising and falling, and so there is some kind of pressure here, or tenseness or whatever, and you can be mindful of that. And here, when you practice as vipassana meditation, you try to concentrate on the nature of breath, on the air element, not really on the breath as a concept. So your mind is here and you are trying to be mindful, but what you are trying to be mindful of is the air element. So keeping the mind on the tip of the nose and be mindful of the breath is practically the same as the mindfulness of the rising and falling movements of the abdomen. But in Visuddhimagga, it is explained that the mindfulness of this is sama meditation. It's called samadhi meditation. It is true, if you take the breath as the concept and you keep your mind on the breath only and not on any other object, even though there may be distractions, you just ignore them and you try to be on the breath in, out, in, out, in, out. You may even make countings like in, one, out, one, in, two, out, two, and so on. So when you are doing like that, you are doing samatha meditation on the breath. And in Visuddhimagga, this method is explained. So Mahasi Syaro did not want to talk much explaining this. This can also be vipassana meditation if you concentrate on the air element rather than on the breath and so on. So he just gave instructions to yogis to keep the mind on the abdomen.
So the part is in the formal form anapanasati, in the breath focusing anapanasati, and in this a tranquility or concentration meditation technique.
I think I have answered this question already. Yes.
But I have written.
Yes.
What makes it vipassana meditation?
What makes what?
If you follow the breath, it's vipassana meditation.
Now, if you read the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness, you will see a subsection in section on contemplation of the body. And that subsection is the section on elements. So there it is said that you are to be mindful of the elements in whatever way you are holding your body. That means whatever elements there are in the body, you be mindful of them. So long as you are mindful of the elements, you are doing the Satipatthana meditation, and so it is Vipassana meditation. So when you concentrate on the breath, not as a breath, as a concept, but as the air element, then you are taking that air element as object. So in that case, this is Vipassana. And the difference between Samatha and Vipassana, another difference is, when you practice Samatha meditation on the breath, you just keep on the breath and you don't pay attention to other objects. But when you practice Vipassana on the air element here, you take the other objects as well when they become prominent. So that is also another difference between Samatha meditation and Vipassana meditation on the same object. So when you keep your mind here and be mindful of the breath as a concept, and you don't pay attention to other objects, then you are doing samatha or anapanasati meditation. But when you are doing here, keeping your mind here, but you are trying to be mindful of the air element, the air element has extending as its characteristic and movement as its function and so on. So when you are concentrating on one of them, then you are doing Vipassana. But when you do Vipassana, you hear a noise, you have to be mindful of that noise, you have pain, and you have to be mindful of that also. And so in Vipassana, there is multiplicity of objects. At different moments, you may be taking different objects, but you choose this to be the main object.
I have read that achieving concentration of one point, thickness of mind, does not lead to wisdom or insight. But Kanya cannot come without concentration. Does the Mahasaya method aim at developing both at the same time by using their attention?
Looks like it. Yeah. In the beginning, the yogi is trying to get concentration. So at the very beginning, there may be no understanding, no panya yet. Because we define panya in this context as understanding mind and matter, understanding their conditionality, understanding their characteristics, and so on. But you do not see them as soon as you sit down and practice. So you have to spend at least some time before you can see mind and matter clearly, and so on. During that part of this practice, what you are doing is trying to get concentration. So concentration is important both in Samatha and Vipassana meditation. Without concentration, there can be no Samatha and there can be no Vipassana, although in Vipassana, Panya is more prominent. But that Panya cannot be prominent without the help of concentration. So Buddha said, monks, develop concentration. The mind of a monk who is concentrated sees things as they really are. So in order to see things as they really are, that means in order to gain Vipassana insight, we need concentration. So in the beginning, we develop this. So in the beginning, there may be no panya proper yet. But as you gain concentration, and in Vipassana meditation we call this momentary concentration or Khanika Samadhi. So when you gain khanika samadhi or momentary concentration, your mind becomes calm and your mind is on the meditation object most of the time. So when the mind stays on the meditation object most of the time and there are very little wanderings, one is said to gain the momentary concentration. So that momentary concentration is as strong as what is called excess concentration or neighborhood concentration, because it can keep the mind stuck on the object and it can keep the mental hindrances away or suppress the mental hindrances away. So it is almost the same as the excess concentration. But in Vipassana, it is not called excess concentration simply because it is not in the neighborhood of a jhana. The excess concentration are in Pali, upachara. So upachara means in the neighborhood. And in the neighborhood means in the neighborhood of jhana. But when you practice Vipassana, you do not get jhana. And so the concentration you get during Vipassana is not in the neighborhood of jhana, and so it is not given the name upachara samadhi. So it is given another name, and that is khanika samadhi or momentary samadhi. Actually, what is samadhi? Samadhi is a mental factor. How long it will last? As mental factor, whichever samadhi it is, it will last for one moment. it will disappear, right? And then in its place, another samadhi will arise and another samadhi will arise. Something like that. Not that one samadhi stays for a long time. There is no such thing. So actually, every samadhi is khanika samadhi. But samatha meditation, that samadhi is called neighborhood concentration. But in vipassana, we call it not neighborhood but khanika or momentary concentration. So without momentary concentration, there can be no vipassana. Momentary concentration is important. We should not look down upon samadhi, right? So samadhi and panya must go together. But in the beginning, as I said, panya may not arise yet because you are trying to get concentration and during those moments you do not see the object clearly, you do not see that it is mind and it is matter and so on. So the real panya may not arise at that moment. But with the growth of the concentration, this realization will come. And so from that stage on, panya and samadhi will go together. Not only these two, mindfulness, concentration, and understanding will go together.
Bhante, in the Theravada tradition, is there a definition for the concept of the absolute or unconditioned? But in the Mahayana tradition, it's called the unborn. Called Brahmakaya, or Buddha nature. In the Theravada tradition, I was wondering what is the equivalent.
Yeah, there is a discourse in the Kundaka Nikaya about Nibbana. So Nibbana is described in those terms, unconditioned, unmade, unborn, unproduced. Yeah, these terms are also in Theravada Buddhism.
So last night we spoke of the arhat dwelling in Palamasati.
Dwelling in what?
Palasamapati.
So that is that's called attainment, right? So That is the outcome of vipassana. So first he must practice vipassana. And before reaching the arahantship, he practices vipassana for attainment of arahantship. So his goal is attainment of arahantship. After he becomes an arahant, he practices vipassana again. And this time, his goal is not to reach another higher stage, because there is no higher stage now. So to reach back what he reached, say, some time ago. So with that aim or direction, he practices vipassana meditation. And as the outcome of that vipassana meditation, now something like the enlightenment arises. But what arises is not path consciousness, because path consciousness arises only once. So in the place of path consciousness, now there arises palat consciousness, fruition consciousness. Path consciousness arises only once and it is gone. But in this attainment thought process, pala moments arise billions and billions of times. One pala moment followed by another pala moment followed by another pala moment. So being in the current of these pala moments is what we call entering into or being in pala samapatti. So as I said last night, it is a kind of vocation taken by arahants.
Is there any more questions?
Yes.
You explained something about four kinds of knowledges that cannot accompany arahants. I see references to the four kinds of knowledge.
The first is the analytical knowledge of the meaning, or the analytical knowledge of the result. Now in Pali it is called Atta Patisambhita. Patisambhita is translated as analytical knowledge, because in the word Patisambhita there is Bida. Bida means to break. So when you break something, that means you analyze something. So that kind of understanding or knowledge that breaks what is to be understood in the Vedas and understand thoroughly is called Patisambhita. And the word Atta means two things: meaning of the word, and also the result. So understanding, thorough understanding of the meaning and thorough understanding of the results is called Atta Patisambhita, the first one. And the second one is called Dhamma Patisambhita. Here Dhamma means the words, the teachings, the words, and also the causes. So thorough understanding of the causes is Dhamma Patisambhita, and thorough understanding of the words, the text, is called Dhamma Patisambhita. And the third is called Niruti Patisambhita. This is thorough understanding of the language. It is said that if you become a noble person with these four kinds of analytical knowledge, you don't have to study Pali language. It will automatically come to you. So if you want to know Pali language, try to become an arahant with these four analytical knowledges. So it is explained as the thorough understanding of the language. That means if somebody makes a mistake, he knows that it is a mistake. If somebody uses a wrong gender for something, then he knows that it is not the right language, and so on. So In the commentaries, it is said the middle Tibeti Sambhita is an understanding of a Pali language. But Maharishi Sierra thought, considering the modern times, it may be just knowledge of languages. For Burmese, knowledge of Burmese language. For you Americans, then knowledge of English language and so on. So understanding language thoroughly is called Nilo Tibeti Sambhita. But if you stick strictly to the commentaries, then this is the thorough understanding of the Pali language. And the last one is called Patibhana Patisambhita. It's difficult to explain. It is thorough understanding of the other three also. But Mahasi Sero explains that it is like you are quick to respond, something like that. When you are talking, you get the word out very quickly, and then the appropriate word, that is through Patibhana. Sometimes you get an idea. Suppose you are a writer, you are a poet, then the words will come to you very easily. That is also Patibhana. Sometimes you may get an idea for a painting, right? Or anything. So that comes to you quickly and at the right moment, the right words. So in a debate, then the words you would use in your answer would come out readily. So such kinds of things is called Patibhana. So these are the four kinds of analytical knowledge that are possessed by many disciples of the Buddha, both non-arahants and arahants.
What is the benefit to watch the breath? Do we get more breath than watch other objects? Do we get more benefit than watching other objects? What benefits of to watch the bread? And do we get more benefit of watching bread than other objects?
Watching the breath or watching anything, watching the movements of the abdomen, is to see it clearly, to understand it, and to gain concentration. Now, when we watch something, when we try to be mindful of something, that is, we want to understand it, we want to see it, we want to know its characteristics, and so on. So watching has that purpose. Now, many people think that watching pain is for the pain to go away. They want to get rid of pain and they watch. And they hope that by watching they can get rid of pain. But what Buddha taught is different. So Buddha taught that for the full understanding of sensations or feelings, you practice foundations of mindfulness and so on. So watching is primarily to develop concentration. And the development of concentration is to understand or to see that object clearly, to see its characteristics and others. There are two